Just breath. Just breath may be all that you need to take a step into optimizing your health. And let's explore the breath and the science in great detail with Nick Heath, aka the Breathing Diabetic. Welcome to the Vital Veda Podcast. Are you ready to go deep into your breath? And the breath will take you into this knowledge. This is a show where we interview experts on the fields of health, consciousness, spirituality, and the laws of nature, which we call the Veda. And the Veda encompasses all the five elements: space, air, fire, water, earth. And we're particularly going to explore air, or known as Vayu in Sanskrit, because the sound, the primordial sound of air is Vayu. And Nick Heath is, I would say, most definitely a breathing nerd. He's called the breathing diabetic because he's simply utilizing breath techniques to manage and improve his type 1 diabetes, which is a medical condition, an autoimmune condition, which really requires 24/7, 365 days a year attention. And we've interviewed another type 1 diabetic, Drew Harrisberg, all on diabetes and blood sugar and just learning about blood sugar and diabetes, because of course type 1 isn't that common, but type 2 is an absolute epidemic all around in multiple countries. And the thing with blood sugars is a lot of people have blood sugar imbalances and pre-diabetes, and the crazy thing is a lot of them don't even know it. So for example, in the US, 1 in 3 people are pre-diabetic. And the crazy thing is 90% of them do not even know it. So pre-diabetes and diabetes and blood sugar imbalances and insulin resistance is huge. It's a huge epidemic. So knowing about diabetes is one thing. But this show is not just about diabetes. This was the pathway which brought Nick into this realm of breath. And we are really exploring breath in a detailed way. You know, so much more beyond just inhaling oxygen, exhaling carbon dioxide. We go into great detail and dispel myths as well and give you some practical techniques for your breath, because, you know, we think it's so simple, but we can utilize it to optimize our health in so many ways. So Nick, he's a scientist. He's an atmospheric scientist by trade, but he's just gone so deep into breathing, and it's so simple as well. So we're going to get deep into this. If you appreciate this work, you know, check out Nick's podcast. It's 411. Check out his website, breathingdiabetic.com. He's got a lot of resources, because what he does is he takes scientific articles and he summarizes them and makes them digestible if you're interested to learn more about this stuff. So check out the other episodes on the Vital Veda podcast. What we do here is health, consciousness, spirituality. We get to interview experts. It's awesome. Check out the other episodes. I'm sure you'll find some nuggets and jewels which you absolutely enjoy. And share this, you know, share it on Instagram, tag Vital Veda and the Breathing Diabetic, leave a review, do what you got to do, and enjoy. Nick Heath, aka the Breathing Diabetic, an early, good, beautiful morning to you, and thank you for joining at the Vital Veda podcast.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Dylan.
The first question we ask every guest is, I think, you know, your wife's a yoga teacher. I don't know how much are you aware of Ayurveda?
Very little. So I just know it's, very little. I'll just say that.
Well, beautiful. Well, one of the key concepts in Ayurveda is called dinacharya, which means daily routine. And having a daily routine is so essential to cultivate those biorhythms and those circadian rhythms and get every organ and cell into routine. So first question we ask every guest is, what is your dinacharya? And usually we ask, what did you do this morning? But I assume that's only been like less than an hour for you. So what's a general morning look like? Or what's a general daily routine look like for you?
Yeah, awesome. And I love that, because I'm huge on routine. I'm a creature of habit, but I usually wake up. So this morning a little differently, but I wake up around 4 or 5 a.m. I immediately do about 15 minutes of slow breathing. So that's my morning breathing practice. Then I do a little bit of gratitude, prayer, just kind of being thankful for being alive for another day. And then make some coffee, do some more breath hold work, while the coffee's brewing. Then I take my dog for a walk and then get to work. So that's kind of, that's my, my normal routine.
It's beautiful. And yeah, let's go into that, including the coffee. And cause you're, okay, your name is The Breathing Diabetic. So we're going to talk about breath today and how it plays a role in health, and not only for blood sugar and diabetes, but for everything. But definitely we will integrate diabetes, and we've also done a podcast giving an overview on diabetes with another type 1 diabetic, which we can, you can check that out with Drew Harrisburg, past episode for you listening. But tell us about your story, because it's so fascinating to hear from type 1 diabetics. I find they have such a profound insight into their own body. You know, hopefully, you know, some maybe are just ignoring it, but still there is this opportunity, because you have to be checking your blood sugar so often, and you have to be, you really monitor, this is what, this food affects me, this exercise affects me, this stress affects me. So they, you're forced into this insight, into this detail, where however much you choose to take it is up to you. And of course, it's an autoimmune condition. It's kind of a, it's not a typical prognosis. So I'd love to hear your story with that.
Yeah, definitely. And that's a perfect way of putting it, that you're forced into learning into your body, because yeah, every little thing affects you differently, and it affects you differently depending on if you did your morning routine or not. How stressed are you? What are you eating? And all of these different factors. How are you sleeping? But yeah, so I got type 1 diabetes when I was 11 years old. Kind of a typical kid, you know, I didn't care too much. It really impacted my life, but I was a skateboarder. I loved to play video games. I just did all the normal kid things, didn't really pay too much attention to it. And I just kind of did enough to get by. And it was around, honestly, it wasn't until I was about 25 that I started really thinking, I can actually do things differently in my life to help my blood sugar. And it sounds ridiculous looking back on it. Like, how could it take until you're 25 to realize you could take control of your blood sugars? But you just, like you just said, it impacts every aspect of your life, and you sometimes feel helpless. Like, it's just like, no matter what I do, nothing works right. So you kind of get in these ways of kind of letting go of it and just saying, I'm just going to live my life and do the best I can. But in any case, I was given a book when I was 25, and I started learning about green things called vegetables and fruits and all these things you could do to, you know, eat healthier and exercise. And so that kind of put me on a path toward optimizing my life from my perspective, not relying on anyone else. What can I do myself that can help my blood sugars? And seeing instant improvements in things like energy levels and my blood sugars, my long-term averages of my blood sugars, that got me excited about it. And that eventually is what led me to things like meditation, yoga, and then eventually a full-on obsession with breathing, which is what it's become now. So yeah, that's my story with diabetes. If you want me to touch on how I got into breathing specifically, I can do that, or whatever you think.
Yeah, let's get to that in a bit. I just want to comment on, it's not stupid to see like how obviously your fingers affect you, because typically at that age, and a lot of people, they go through type 1 diabetes and just think, I can't do anything about it. It's just, I'm going to continue exactly the same that I'm living, but I got to inject insulin. That's it. But we're going now back to baby steps of actually you guys do have control over your blood sugar levels, and there are things you can do and shift it. So I even today, people know that they're still passive to not giving themselves enough empowerment of, you have significant empowerment over your blood sugars. And I'd like to speak about that, and also about why that is important, because I could just say I'll just keep taking insulin whenever I need and maintain that level which the doctor's telling me to maintain. Why do I need to put this effort into breathing, into eating, into doing a routine where I'll just do what my usual life is and just inject insulin to keep my levels stable?
Yeah, it's a mental thing. It gives you a little bit of power, and it gives you hope. I mean, that's what's really important, is feeling like it's going to be better tomorrow or in a month or in 10 years. There's a lot of things around diabetes. We have to worry about long-term complications. We have to worry about being in a bad mood and upsetting our partner because our blood sugars were low, and all of these things can emotionally just drain you. And that's why diabetics have a much higher prevalence of anxiety, of depression, of all these things, because it's a real emotional toll on you. It takes on you. And so by getting yourself a little bit of control, it's helping stabilize that by saying, okay, there are steps I can do. Now, of course, I'm never going to be perfect. I'm never going to figure it out and be the best diabetic on the planet, but I know I have some control now, and that gives me back some power, and that gives me a lot of peace of mind, a lot of, okay, yes, I had a high blood sugar, but let me figure out why, and let me try to fix it next time, and just be a little bit better. And so just giving you that control, I think, really helps with the emotional and the mental aspect of having a disease that, as far as we know, isn't going away anytime soon. And, you know, what's the best way to manage it? And I think having that positive outlook and a little bit of hope really helps.
And I assume there's also some biological benefits of not needing to inject with as much insulin.
Oh, yeah. And that's a huge one is, you know, once you start doing these things and you notice improvements, yeah, your insulin levels might go down. I don't want to sound like you're going to cure yourself or anything, but, you know, my insulin levels went down significantly from both originally when I started eating better and exercising more, and then when I started implementing some of the breathing methods that I do now. And yeah, that has some huge biological effects, because what we're talking about, it's all interconnected and circular, because if you're feeling better and happier, that's going to lead to more optimism toward managing your blood sugars, which is going to make you feel biologically better, which is going to help you, again, manage your blood sugars better. And it kind of snowballs in a positive way of improvements leading to more improvements. So yeah, there's a lot of good things physiologically and emotionally that are happening concurrently.
And as you alluded to earlier, preventing those deeper conditions that may occur in the past, like neuropathy and eye disorders, so many things that which can come with diabetics. And what's the difference in the amount of exogenous insulin that you're using now compared to before, when you were 25 or before 25?
You know, I don't know the exact number at this point. When I first started with the breathing, it was about a 20% reduction. If I went back to 25, oh gosh, I'm sure it's a lot more than that. I would say probably maybe 40, 45% less insulin I'm taking. So yeah, no exact numbers, but also some other changes were I used to wear an insulin pump. And so the basal rate it's a little bit different comparing apples to apples. Now I use injections with long-term insulin and then short-term when I eat meals. So there's a little difference, but with the breathing particularly, I saw some pretty dramatic lowering of my insulin levels.
Beautiful. We'll get into the benefits of breathing and speak about blood sugars. But before we do, I want to go back to basics with breathing, because we typical education in school or whatever have this knowledge of oxygen is good and CO2 is bad. Like, we breathe in what's good and we want to get rid of CO2. The trees and the plants are doing the dirty work for us. Thank God they're collecting our CO2. So I kind of want to just look at those two fundamental molecules and examine them, particularly about actually maybe CO2 has wonderful benefits and can be used in an important way.
Yeah, definitely. And that's probably the biggest surprise and the biggest, I guess, aha moment when you start learning about the physiology of breathing, is that CO2 actually becomes one of the most important gases in the blood. And so, of course, we do exhale to get rid of CO2. And it's actually CO2, which is our driver to breathe. So when you feel that onset of breathlessness, if you were holding your breath and that first urge to breathe, that's actually your body sensing higher levels of carbon dioxide, not low levels of oxygen. So carbon dioxide ends up being a real central focus when we talk about breathing. But what's kind of interesting when you talk about oxygen and carbon dioxide, and like you just mentioned, the basic understanding most of us get that CO2 is bad, let's get rid of it, is that CO2 actually plays an important role in getting oxygen to your cells. So when you're breathing and you know you bring oxygen in, it goes into your lungs, it diffuses into the blood, and then it gets carried around to all of the places that it needs it. And so one key component to getting the oxygen from the blood into the cells is carbon dioxide. So carbon dioxide helps loosen that bond between the oxygen and the hemoglobin so that you can actually use the oxygen more efficiently. And so this is referred to as the Bohr effect. The scientist who discovered it was Christian Bohr, I think back in the early 1900s. And so that kind of reverses our understanding of carbon dioxide. It's not only a waste gas, so to speak, but it's also an important signaling mechanism to get that oxygen where it needs to go. And so some things you learn in pranayama and basic, a lot of breath work methods now, is to actually reduce the volume of breaths you take. So you reduce each breath you take, you reduce the volume a little bit, and that helps you build up your levels of carbon dioxide, which counterintuitively lets you get more oxygen into the cells. So it's kind of a less is more scenario where by breathing less, you actually deliver more oxygen to your cells.
So if I get this right, if I now exhale, and if you're listening, you can exhale and hold your breath out, you have a lot of CO2. So that's going to trigger your body's mechanisms to absorb more oxygen.
Yes.
Is that right?
Exactly. Okay. And it's like it's a messenger. It kind of makes sense when you think about it, because if CO2 is building up, that means you're not breathing, right? That means you're not getting more oxygen in. And so your body's response is to say, well, we need a way to get more oxygen because we know we're not getting any more with this high level of CO2. And so it loosens that bond between the hemoglobin and the oxygen, and it lets it get released into the cells. And so The big problem is that our habitual, you know, stress, sitting at a computer all day, working, looking at social media, we've started over-breathing a lot because we're just under this constant state of, you know, hunched over, breathing through our mouths. And so a big part of what a lot of the breathing is at first it feels a little uncomfortable, but what we're trying to do is just get breathing back to its normal volume so that you have normal levels of carbon dioxide, so that your tissues and your organs and your muscles are getting the oxygen they need.
I heard a stat, I can't remember where, I think it was with Dr. John Dooliard. Do you know, are you familiar with his work?
Yeah, a little bit, yes.
He's an Ayurvedic. He started talking about breathing a while ago, I think in the 80s or 90s. And anyway, I think he said, we did a podcast with him and he spoke about breath, and that 75% of oxygen that people breathe in, they breathe out unused.
So yeah, it's pretty crazy, huh?
Yeah. So we're not becoming efficient with utilizing our oxygen. And I believe also with carbon dioxide, they even used to use those in clinics in for like anxiety and things.
Yeah, and because it's such a strong trigger for breathing, it can actually induce panic, but it can also kind of condition you to withstand panic a little bit more. And so, for example, with anxiety, a lot of breathwork techniques try to teach you to tolerate a little bit higher levels of carbon dioxide, just so that you can train your body to withstand panic a little bit better, because that's the most primal urge you're going to ever face, is that feeling of, I need to breathe, you know, and that's the most, yeah. So in any case, you can use it as a way to treat anxiety and panic and conditions like that.
It's just sedative.
Yes.
So I want to bring in the relationship between breath holds, also it can be like intermittent hypoxia, and CO2. I mean, we just learned, okay, there's the CO2. If we kind of learn to utilize that better, we'll get more oxygen, but not just breathing oxygen, actually getting the oxygen into our cells. So that's the most important part. And I believe hypoxia or intermittent hypoxia and holding our breath, that plays a big role in assisting in that.
Yeah. And so intermittent hypoxia training, it kind of has two goals. Well, there's several goals, but one is to teach yourself to withstand these higher levels of carbon dioxide. So by, like you just mentioned, an exhale, holding your breath, that can, CO2 is going to build up very quickly in the blood. And that's going to teach you to withstand these higher levels of CO2, which is going to teach you in your everyday breathing to breathe less air more effortlessly. And so there's kind of that component of the CO2, but then the actual holding of the breath, if you hold it long enough, you'll also drop your blood oxygen saturation. And so that might seem counterintuitive. Why would we want to drop our blood oxygen saturation? We know that can be very harmful, but it turns out if you do it in a controlled manner, it can be very therapeutic. And in fact, it can help with insulin sensitivity. So that's one reason I became interested in it, but it can also help with immune function. And what it does is your body, your spleen actually contracts and releases more red blood cells into circulation. And so it's compensating. It's saying, oh, there's less oxygen. We need a way to carry more oxygen next time. And so the long-term effects is that it can potentially improve your oxygen carrying capacity. So the short-term stressor of low oxygen can long-term help you carry more oxygen so that you can get, you know, more oxygen where it's needed. So there's kind of a twofold component of dropping the oxygen saturation and increasing the carbon dioxide.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. And that spleen pushing more oxygen into the rest of the body and more blood, that's going to improve blood flow, right? That's going to improve circulation, heart health.
Yeah. And you'll feel it kind of almost immediately if you do some for breath hold practices, you need to be in good health. There's a lot of kind of disclaimers because it can be dangerous. But for the most part, we all, you know, dove to the bottom of our pool when we were kids and things like that. So it's generally safe for most people. But yeah, the immediate effect is you'll actually feel pretty energized. So if you do it, you know, 10 minutes before a workout or before a nice walk or before a yoga class, and that's actually how I used to do it quite a bit, was do some breath holds and then go do yoga. It kind of gives you that burst of energy because you're releasing more red blood cells into circulation, getting more oxygen.
Beautiful. And is that energy sustaining throughout the day, or is it just going to be a quick hit?
So for the most part, the breath holds are, it's mainly a quick hit from what I've noticed, but there's a lot of long-term benefits. So I think I know for sure with regular practice, the energy is sustained throughout the day. So that's why I try to do some sort of breath hold practice in the morning. But if you're new to it, the first time, you know, the first few times will be kind of a quick hit. I think the increase in red blood cell count from the spleen contraction lasts anywhere from like 10 to 30 minutes. So that initial kind of energetic boost, let's say, is going to last just, you know, maybe half an hour. But there are long-term effects on EPO, which is going to stimulate red blood cell production and things like that. So there's kind of two components where now you have the short-term benefits. And then if you practice it consistently, you can get the long-term benefits too.
One of my teacher's prescriptions for low hemoglobin is pranayama, is doing breath and also adding, and we can talk about this later, in Ayurveda we have this practice called nasya, which is sniffing medicated oil up the nose and then doing pranayama. And this kind of enhances the turbines in the nostrils and that filtering capacity, and so many benefits of nasya, but it increases that, carries the blood flow to the brain and many things. So, and I want to add, when the intermittent hypoxia or holding the breath, when I've done it in pranayamas, so pranayama, for those who don't know, prana means life force and pranayama means to administer or to expand. So it's a typical yogic practice of administering life force, administering prana to the cells, and breath holds are a part of it. In fact, some would say probably the most beneficial part of it, but it's much easier to do the breath hold after some time of doing some breathing, you know, whatever the breathing routine and timings are. And then coupling that with the breath hold makes it much more beneficial. And what I've spoken to another friend who's a yoga teacher about, for example, the Wim Hof method, which is very hyperventilation, at least from what most people see it as. So it's a lot of breathing, particularly through the mouth, excess. And which for me, and we'll talk about nasal and mouth breathing, but when I see people doing, for example, Wim Hof or strong inhale and exhale through the mouth, huge, the key for that is, and apparently what Wim Hof really wanted to teach, which apparently didn't get around so much, is you have to couple that with a breath retention. Because if you don't, that hyperventilation is going to cause that stress. I mean, when you see a tiger, you go, like you're not breathing calmly. So it's just it feels so stressful. Sure, you feel high after it, but like you said, that oxygen saturation kind of, or whatever it was in the blood. But yeah, so the importance of, well, the benefit of integrating that holding the breath, which we've just spoken about, is very beneficial with breathing practices.
Yeah, that's a super important part. And there's kind of two or a few different like camps of how people do it, and they're all beneficial in their own way. You just mentioned the most popular one, which is Wim Hof, and that's actually how I got interested in breathing. So I really enjoy the Wim Hof method. And like you just said, he had the best intentions, and it can get carried away. And there's a lot of things that people kind of, I guess, misinterpret. But with the Wim Hof method, you're doing the hyperventilation, which is making you very alkaline. You're increasing your pH. You're getting rid of all that CO2, but then you hold the breath, and you can hold the breath for a really long time because, as we were just talking about, carbon dioxide is your trigger to breathe. Mm-hmm. And so when you inhale, do these big breaths, and you're breathing and breathing for, let's say, 30 big breaths, and then you just kind of let go, and you can just hold your breath for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes. Some people can hold their breath for a really long time. And so it's this basically fight or flight, you know, you're breathing heavy, it's triggering the stress response, then you let go and you just relax, and it's very peaceful. You're just kind of, no, you don't feel any urge to breathe, you're just enjoying it. And then because you got rid of all that carbon dioxide, your blood oxygen saturation plummets. People get down to below 50%, which from most medical standpoints would be very, very unsafe, close, you know, to death, but it's in a controlled manner. So then when you take that final big breath in afterward, it floods the system with, you know, adrenaline and things like that, because you tricked your body into dropping your blood oxygen saturation to levels it's not supposed to experience. And so you get this flood of adrenaline. I think the one or two studies that have looked at it said you get more adrenaline than someone their first time bungee jumping, because it's just this crazy primal state you tap into with into your brainstem and all of these different things. So that's kind of one really interesting way of using breath work. And Wim Hof you kind of go through these phases where you think, oh, he's a genius. And then you think, well, I don't know, you're not supposed to hyperventilate. And then you realize why he was doing it, and his method of taking you up and then back down and up. And it's kind of this workout for your entire autonomic nervous system. And that's why he's seen such, you know, fantastic results with so many different conditions. But then there's also other types of breath work you can incorporate. Like, for example, if you just sit and breathe slowly for a few minutes at, let's say, 5 or 6 breaths per minute, that actually has been shown to reduce your chemosensitivity, meaning that buildups in carbon dioxide won't bother you as much. Drops in oxygen saturation won't bother you as much. And so by doing some paced breathing where you're doing equal inhales and exhales at a more slow rate, not like Wim Hof, but more like 5 or 6 breaths per minute, then if you did some breath holds, you might still, you'll see a different kind of benefit, because in this case, your CO2 is going to be higher, but you've balanced your autonomic nervous system. You're in a really healthy state. And so then when you do the breath hold, you'll be able to prolong it a little bit farther and build up your CO2 a little bit more. And then there's other kind of practices where people are purposefully trying to just go on the extreme end of CO2, where, say, you might do some very light breathing and then exhale fully and then hold your breath and walk around or jog and things like that. And that's going to really get you acidic, and it's going to really be a big stressor mentally, physically. And that's training you basically for more of athletics and performance and things like that.
Mm-hmm. I want to explore a couple of things. First of all, back to the hyperventilation, also known as Wim Hof, is doing hyperventilation. Even through the nose, you can do some strong breathing. Obviously, it's not as hyper as mouth breathing. So I want to understand that adrenaline, because when you do that and you hold your breath, you're like, whoever's done it, if you haven't, you should try it if it's safe. You know, you feel like it's orgasmic. Your body is tingling, your fingertips are tingling. It's just beautiful state. It's a beautiful sensation. So is that because I thought I was about to, I don't know, lose, you said, less than 50% oxygen saturation, and then I finally got to breathe in, I'm like, oh, thank you so much. Is that why the adrenaline is coming? It's like, because yes, I'm now alive. And then you hold that space. Is that what it is?
So I think so. I don't know if anyone knows exactly why you're getting that crazy adrenaline rush, but I believe it is. So it's that extreme drop in oxygen saturation, and it's different for everyone. So I use a pulse oximeter, and when I practice it, typically I get in like the 70s, which is still pretty, you know, not okay. If I do three rounds or four rounds, yeah, I'm going to drop into the 60s or upper 50s. And then, yeah, some people will just drop way lower. But in any case, yeah, getting that really low drop in blood oxygen saturation is telling your brain, I'm going to die, right? I need, and then when you take that and hold it, it seems to do something where, it, like you just said, it's like, yes, and it floods the body with adrenaline. Like, you know, it's an extreme state of fight or flight of I am about to be, you know, fighting for my life at this moment. And it really gives you that euphoric feeling. And I see it's certainly addictive, that's for sure.
Mm. So then as to what you were saying about the long or the slow inhale and exhale through the nose, let's talk about the difference between nasal breathing and mouth breathing, because obviously we've just seen two parallels with the two you've just mentioned. I mean, it's coming out so much more now with the popular book Breath by James Nestor, and it's just becoming more and more that mouth breathing is not so beneficial, and that actual nasal breathing is so beneficial, particularly with exercise. And just get an overview on that. And I want to say, like, I see people at the beach, I live at the beach, and people exercising, and they're just huffing and puffing and through their mouth, absolutely. And this is going to be very common with people exercising, and they're straining and breathing through their mouth as a result, because they're past their capacity. So yeah, bring in that as well. And should they be reassessing? Are they really getting such benefits if they think they are?
Yeah, there's a lot of components of nasal breathing that, like you just said, are becoming much more well known. So the first most important thing is that it reduces your breathing volume naturally. So by teaching yourself to breathe through your nose consistently, it's going to help you breathe less and make your breathing more efficient. It also does a lot of things for filtering, cleaning the air. So we have all these little turbinates that help things stick, you know, so that not as many particles make it down. We also have a gas called nitric oxide that's being continuously generated in our paranasal sinuses. And this is kind of a wonder molecule for all of breathing. And so first off,
he won the Nobel Prize in 1998.
Yes, that's right. And that was, yeah, for other reasons too, besides just breathing. There's so many fascinating things with nitric oxide, but in your nasal cavity, when it gets released, it helps to sterilize the incoming air. So it's antiviral, antibacterial, all of these things. So it's helping clean the air out. Plus, when it gets into your lungs, it's a vasodilator. And so it's going to open up those blood vessels. It's going to improve blood flow and help you get more oxygen into your blood with each breath you take. And this is significantly important when, like you and I are sitting up straight right now, when you're walking and things like that, gravity would tend to focus blood toward the base of the lungs. And so what inhaling through your nose does is it brings nitric oxide down and it redistributes the blood flow in your lungs. And this is helping to utilize the massive surface area of the lungs, make it more effective. And so there's actually been a paper, I think it was in 2010, that hypothesized that nasal nitric oxide was an evolutionary adaptation to allow us to walk upright, which is just crazy when you think about it. And of course, breathing is life, right? That's what pranayama tells us. Breath is life. And so it's not that far-fetched to believe that a major evolutionary adaptation would be finding a way to get us oxygen in the upright position. I don't know if anything has confirmed these studies. You know, that one study isn't, you know, that important, I guess, but it's a fascinating idea. And it just makes a lot of common sense that would be an important part of nasal nitric oxide. But so if we reverse that, when you breathe through your mouth, you're missing all of those benefits immediately. You're going to overbreathe. So you're going to be breathing in more air, which is going to be detrimental to your carbon dioxide levels. You're also missing this filtering component. You're significantly reducing the amount of nitric oxide you get. And if you breathe through your nose, it has a tendency to just naturally activate the diaphragm more. So we always breathe with our diaphragm, but you get a little bit deeper breath. It naturally activates that stomach breathing a little bit more, which we all know is important for calming and things like that. And so when you're breathing through your mouth, most people could, if they're sitting listening to this, they could give it a try right now. If you take a big deep breath through your mouth, you have a tendency to bring your shoulders up and it's upper chest, and you're really, so it's two things are happening. Now you're breathing into the top of your lungs, so you're not getting as much blood gas matching, and you're not getting the nitric oxide, which is there to redistribute the blood flow. And so you're basically, it's the most inefficient way of breathing through your mouth.
Like neglecting that lower part of the body, the lower abdomen, the lower lobes of the lungs. And
there are times for mouth breathing. And I think that's one thing with the Wim Hof method, especially, is that if you watch videos of Wim Hof, he's always breathing through his nose. James Nestor makes the point that he, most of the time he's humming, he's doing all these things that are really good nasal breathing. And it's just when he practices for 10 minutes a day or 15 minutes a day that he's mouth breathing. And the rest of the time he's pretty much nasal breathing. So anyone who's really into breathing is going to eventually come across the nose, and Wim Hof is no different. So it's just something to keep in mind. If you are a big fan of Wim Hof, like I am, he is mainly a nose breather.
And what you said about the diaphragm is so important, because I think nasal breathing is very important for digestion, particularly hyperacidity, reflux, that kind of when that upward, we call it Udvarta in Ayurveda, like when the digestive energy or tract or gas is going up, and it kind of causes that, you know, acidity or reflux or heartburn or hernia. So I think the nasal breathing itself can play a big role in help healing those issues, that acid.
Yeah. And you hear that a lot from people, whether it's in books or just interactions with people who are doing breath work, is that their digestion improves. And that diaphragm is massaging the organs, you know, so it's helping with your large and small intestines and things like that. It's helping. It needs to move. The other organs are expecting it to move and to put pressure on them and things like that. And so by just breathing nasally, you're doing it naturally, which is going to help, like you just said, with all these components of digestion.
You've mentioned breathing less. So like some of the things you say is people thinking, what? It's good to breathe less and it's bad to breathe more. So I would love you to speak on that. And I would like to add, when I meditate, because I do a technique where I transcend, I'm hardly breathing. And I think there were studies on people who were doing this transcendental meditation, and they were like, you could measure some of them and there's no, maybe even hard to measure. You see yogis who are in the forest doing this, they're probably maybe appear clinically dead. Mm-hmm. But I know from my personal experience, like I'm hardly breathing. There's so little air. So we'll talk about that. Is that beneficial?
Yeah, that's one of the most I shouldn't say that. There's a lot of beneficial aspects to meditation that go beyond just the breathing part. But the fact that you're reducing your breathing volume, what they call it is a hypometabolic state. So you're in a hypometabolism.
Yes.
And you're basically training your body to withstand a little bit less oxygen and a little bit more carbon dioxide by going into this very slow, very subtle breathing, like you just said, barely noticeable. And what that does is it teaches you to be more efficient. And so if you're sitting there, let's say for 15, 20, 30 minutes, and you're barely breathing at all, your body makes adaptations and says, okay, you just trained me essentially to do better, do more with less. And so this transitions into your everyday life. And so some of the studies I've seen have basically exactly what you just said, is that the body goes into this state, and then it goes for the rest of the day, is where the body's more efficient at breathing. Your heart is in better condition. All of these things are in better condition because you sat there and you're breathing so lightly for so little time. And so that goes back to things like carbon dioxide. So again, you're teaching your body to withstand higher levels of carbon dioxide. But there's also the autonomic nervous system component. So a lot of meditations, not all of them, but a lot end up, your breath just naturally paces downward to around 6 breaths per minute or in that general ballpark, which is very beneficial for the cardiovascular and autonomic nervous systems. And so you're getting all of these benefits without even having to worry about the breath. It's kind of a byproduct of the meditation itself. And so I focus on the breathing component. There's a lot of other things going on with the mind, but it's a really fascinating thing with meditation.
And the difference between that and what people call quote unquote shallow breathing, I guess, would that be literally what we're talking about with the mouth, of shallow in the in the chest, high up on the chest. But yeah, also what is shallow breathing? I don't even know what is a good definition, and is it bad? Is it good? Because you'd think like you're highly breathing, but yeah, what's the difference there?
So yeah, you can think of it shallow and deep, right? Shallow would be not going as deep into your lungs. Deep would be filling your lungs completely with air. Now, it's kind of a more, what we talk about is more activation of the diaphragm. So when we say shallow breathing, typically what people are talking about is upper chest, like shoulders moving up and down and things like that. But there are, so there's techniques like Buteyko. And when they say shallow breathing, they're really, they call it breathe light. Some people call it shallow breathing, but what they're really referring to is just breathing less, just barely taking sips of air, mimicking without the meditation component, mimicking that state you reach when you're meditating. And so some people refer to, just so listeners, if they hear it, looking up Buteyko and things like that, they might say, well, they talk about shallow breathing, but I thought that was bad. Some breathwork practices like Buteyko are just talking about reducing breathing volume. So to get into that state, that hypometabolic state, and they call it shallow breathing. But for the general public, we think about shallow as upper chest, shoulders moving, and then deep breathing as that slow horizontal breathing where your belly's moving out, your back's moving out, but your chest and shoulders are remaining motionless.
I love it. So now, about in regards to nasal breathing or mouth breathing, sleep, like it's such a big one. And now still not popular enough, but definitely getting there, is people taping their mouth at night. And it's so funny when I tell patients that, because it's just like they're so surprised. And I'm like, this is so like easy and like it's going to help a lot. So obviously, we just discussed nasal breathing is so important. And when you're asleep for, I don't know, 8 hours or so a night, and it's meant to be your most regenerative time. So you want to optimize that, and it's so important. And we've spoken about it with a holistic dentist about taping your mouth. And yeah, what's your view on how helpful it is?
Yeah, that was the thing that changed my life, that got me so fascinated with breathing. Because like you just said, it's so simple. You just put the tape on, go to bed. And then I woke up with an insane amount of energy. And I thought, this can't be real.
You've sold 10 years of my problems exactly. Like that.
Honestly, that's how I felt. It was like, how is it? I even have the email, I think, on my website now. Because a few days after it, I emailed my wife. And I was just like, this is crazy. Like, it's so simple. And I'm literally bursting with energy throughout the day. I had become a chronic mouth breather. So it had, you know, exponentially better effects for me just because I'd gotten so habitually. Yeah, I was bad. But in any case, yeah, mouth tape is, I call it the passive income of health, right? It's an investment. You make one little quick investment right before you go to sleep. And the rest of the night, you're just getting all these benefits of nasal breathing that we just talked about for, like you said, maybe 7, 8, 9 hours a night. It's going to help you get to deeper sleep. So a lot of people who wear Oura rings and things like that, that's one thing they notice, is that their time in deep sleep is improved. There have been studies showing that basically switching from mouth to nose decreases the incidence of obstructive sleep apnea. And so it just kind of makes sense. Mouth breathing, you're going to get cooler, drier air entering your upper airways. That's going to cause irritation. It's going to cause inflammation and all of these things. And so that's going to lead to things like obstructive sleep apnea or airway collapse. Whereas when you breathe through your nose, it's going to be just more beneficial for your lungs. Your upper airways are going to be much happier. And there's also some sort of rhythm detector in your nose, where basically by breathing through your nose at night, it keeps your breath more rhythmic and more constant. And so that's really important. That's what these CPAP machines are trying to do, is, you know, keep that pressure in, keep your breathing consistent. And so by breathing nasally, you kind of get that naturally. And so, yeah, I'm a huge advocate of the mouth tape. It sounds crazy, and I understand that it sounds a little funky, like you said, a lot of your patients do. But it's if you can withstand it, it's one of the easiest things you can do to help your breathing.
Yeah, I think the shock from my patients and from people are just like, what? Like, you're telling me this? This is your prescription? Like, I've just given you such a It's such a drastic complaint. But first of all, I want to acknowledge preventing sleep apnea is a very wise thing to do. And what a beautiful, easy way. And what about those with sleep apnea? Because sleep apnea is kind of when you kind of go through these stages of you need to you need to take a gasp because your body thinks it's out of breath, or it's like, yeah, it needs to take a gasp of breath. But I would think, I don't know, what about for those with sleep apnea? Can it be dangerous? Because it's like, well, what if you can't do that? Is that going to cause some other reaction, or will they just take that gasp through the nose?
Yeah, that's a really good question that I'm not sure about, but I would think I'm not a medical doctor, so I try to do those disclaimers, but from what I've seen, yeah, it would be the same, right? You might gasp through your nose, but hopefully you would have less incidence of it. Now, of course, it's not going to do that for everyone. Everyone has different root causes and things, but that seems like the first place we should start is with nasal breathing, and then add on other modalities, other things, maybe doing slow breathing before bedtime, as that might help put you in a more parasympathetic, calm state to help you sleep deeper. And then with the mouth tape, breathing through your nose. But there's a doctor or a dentist, Dr. Mark Berhenny, and he speaks a lot about mouth tape. And I like listening to him just because he has the credentials and he can talk really, positively about it and he has hardly any reservations about having people try out the tape. So I don't know about with obstructive sleep apnea. I don't want to speak on his behalf there, but it seems like that would be the first place to start to see if it helps and then move from there.
And I'm sure if you were to try it under the guidance of your doctor or practitioner, it may be at first, it may be a little shocking because you're kind of getting out of that habit of taking it through the breath. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's so many things you can do for that. And we have other measures in Ayurveda like the nasal oil and certain steam inhalations to open up the sinus cavities. And in regards to what to use, just for those to know, so I admit I don't think I need it. I've never known to snore. I have great energy in the morning. My partner, on the other hand, she snores. So we started using it for her. And we just got the simple paper tape from a chemist, from the pharmacy, with like a dollar or two. But she wasn't liking, we tried a few, but what she didn't like with the tapes was the chemicals. Because the paper tape kind of wasn't that good or sticking, or I don't know. And then we kind of got this better, but she didn't like the chemicals. So we got these literally tapes made for mouth. They're kind of one-time uses. It's a bit more expensive. It's probably going to cost like a dollar or two a night, I think, as opposed to a few cents per night if you get a roll of tape. So those are some options. What do you use? Or do you tape your mouth?
Oh, yeah. I can't even take a nap without it.
How long have you been taping your mouth?
Let's see, since 2017, so late 2017, so wow, close to 4 years now. Mm-hmm. But I use just 3M Micropore, the kind of cheap generic tape. I've tried some of the fancy ones and I love them, but for me, I'm like, I don't want to spend the money. I can buy like 20 rolls on Amazon and be set for a year. But there's Simply Breathe is one I know is really good. And the founder, I think it's Simply Breathe, the founder's daughter is a type 1 diabetic. Oh. And so just interesting things there, small connection. Mm. But there's OmniFix, there's Somnifix, there's a lot of them out there. So if people are interested and they want a product that's designed for this purpose, you can Google it and find several options now, and that might, yeah. But I just use the 3M Micropore paper tape.
I would go with that because I just think it's ridiculous to have a new one every time, just yeah. Paper tape, simple. But my question is, if you've been doing it for 4 years and you said you were a chronic mouth breather before, I mean, how long do you think you're going to be doing it? Are you going to get to a place where you've trained yourself to nasal breathe at night?
Well, I think I have. I don't think I would breathe through my mouth anymore. And I don't know if there's any studies to prove how long it takes. Mm-hmm. I think everyone's going to be a little different. For me, it's kind of a few things. One is it's a habitual trigger for my sleep now. It's like when I put that tape on, And Patrick McCown, the person who I trained under, who taught me a lot of everything I know about breathing, he's the same way. Like, he's been doing it for like 15 years. And it's more of like, mm-hmm. when you put on the tape, since it became such a correlate for me of sleep and deep sleep, it's like, okay, I'm going to bed. This is my sign. And I go to bed a lot quicker. And I also just like
it's
to
like,
do it.
It's like me. It's like me massaging my feet with oil before bed. When I do that, I know I'm going to get deep sleep.
Yeah, but we were learning more and more through sleep, the research, that routine, you know, nighttime routine is so important. And so for me, it's that same trigger every single time of putting on the mouth tape. And then I also like to do it because I ask a lot of people to do it. And so I do it every night. So I'm not telling you something I wouldn't do or I haven't done or things like that. So I have it on my website everywhere, you know, tape your mouth. It's the best thing ever, blah, blah, blah. So
that's good. If you snore, if your partner in bed tells you your mouth breathe, if you wake up with low energy, do it. It's so easy. It's very, very cheap. And for someone like me who I would say, to be fair, since my partner does say, yeah, Dylan, you mouth breathe, maybe I mouth breathe 10-20% generous, I don't know, of my night. I really don't know. Yeah, and as I said, I wake up with great energy. I should do a research project with myself. I just, to be honest, I've tried it a bit, and yeah, I know you have to get through that initial stage of discomfort and something new being on your mouth when you sleep. But yeah, for those who don't, the snore or any of those things.
Yeah, and that's the other thing is it might not help everyone. So really, it's real personal. Like when I listened to the podcast with Patrick McCown that got me into all the breathing, it was the mouth tape that really, it struck a chord with me. And I knew because I was waking up with such low energy and all of this. And so it's almost like my body told me, you need to do this. Like this, you, like it was telling me, alarms were going off like, oh, this might be your issue. Cause you always have a dry mouth. You always, you know, you're so low on energy during the day. So it might not cure everything for everyone. So, but if it's standing out to you, give it a try. And if you wake up with great energy, maybe, you know, it's not really worth it for you because, for example, in your case, you do lots of different things to for your health, and mouth breathing or taping your mouth might be, you know, not very important since you do so many other things. And like you said, you wake up with great energy, you know, if it's not broke, don't fix it. So there's a common sense balance I like to try to keep in mind too.
Yeah. Beautiful. And is there a time for mouth breathing?
Of course. Yeah.
Besides when you see a tiger.
Yeah, when you see a tiger. If you're like, let's say you're an extreme athlete and you are breaking records, yes, breathe through your mouth. Do whatever, you know. I think the important thing is to train, you know, doing breathing correctly. And then when you go into a contest or something, just do whatever your body tells you to do. If it's nasal, mouth, just kind of follow what is right for your level of exertion. I actually went to altitude for the first time. I hiked up to 13,000 feet with a friend of mine, and I went into it with that mentality. I just want to make it. You know, I do all this breathing training, but I live in Florida. I'm like basically below sea level at this point. You know, I'm right on the ocean. And so to go up to 13,000 feet, I was mouth breathing quite a bit. On the way up, I would say, and I did this purposefully. I was like, whatever I feel, I was taking big breaths to keep my oxygen saturation at a decent level. And so there's different scenarios where mouth breathing is okay. I think the key though is to try to reduce it as much as you can. And if you're like an everyday like person, you're doing yoga classes, things like that, keep it, you know, nasal as much as you possibly can, that you're going to get the most benefits and you're going to be feeling healthier overall. So extreme scenarios, mouth breathe, otherwise nasal breathe.
Even if you think, but in my yoga, if I push harder and really try to keep up with the class, I have to nasal breathe. Or if my personal trainer is telling me to do this, and that's going to make me do more movement, more exercise, more weights, more running, whatever it is, I have to nasal breathe in order to do that. What about that, Nick? Is that going to support my physiology and my exercise?
Well, it depends on your goals, right? If your goal is overall health, then yes, just nasal breathe. I use my nasal breathing in everyday exercise, everything. I call it my pacemaker. If I feel like I can't maintain nasal breathing, then I say, well, I'm pushing myself a little too hard at this point.
Love that.
And it's time to step it back a notch, because my goal is health. My goal is to be the healthiest I can be. I have no desire to break a world record or anything like that. And
or
so
get muscles or
huge. So I think for most people, use it as your pacemaker. And if someone's, you know, telling you to breathe through your mouth to go harder, you know, to push farther, if that's what you want to do, okay. But if you don't, just say, you know, I've read about the benefits of nasal breathing, or I heard about the benefits of nasal breathing, and I'm going to stick with that for now. And so, yeah, I use it as my pacemaker, and that's the best advice I can give in those scenarios.
I love it. I love it. I tell all my patients, mostly, who, when I ask them about the exercise, I ask everyone, of course, what exercise, and it's the key is I never had to use the word pacemaker, but I might use it now, is that's your gauge. That's your barometer. Like, if your mouth breathing is too much and you generate, and I'll speak from experience as well, who's just started running because I've moved further away from the beach, which means I have to run there. So I always go to the beach every day, and I now have to run up a hill. And that's kind of the first time that I was doing more cardio and strenuous exercise. And for me, it's when you nasal breathe and you kind of maintain that limit, and that's your barometer, you obtain this mastery over your exercise, over your movement. It's not the exercise is pulling you or overwhelming you. It's this mastery. And there you kind of reap this more power, this more physiological benefit, this prana. It's just like, I'm getting so much more. Not that I'm in a battle and my body is under stress. And, you know, yes, I'm moving in heart rate and blood flow, but as you said, that's not exactly necessarily health. Mm-hmm. You know, you can get full blood flow and full oxygen and like strong and flexible by having that flow and that mastery. So pacemaker, love it.
Yeah. And with exercise, you know, the first sign of fatigue is that feeling of breathlessness of, you know, you start panting. And so if you can control that, it's going to help you. Like you just said, it's going to give you that sense of control, that sense of I'm taking control of my exercise, and you're going to have much better recovery and things like that. And which is going to make your workouts that much more beneficial. So yeah, there's a lot of things that using nasal breathing during exercise can help with for the everyday athlete or the everyday, you know, just someone who's trying to be healthy.
Yeah. And there's studies showing that nasal breathing will enhance the recovery time, make it shorter. Mm-hmm. So just before we wrap up, I want to go through a few conditions. I know obviously all these, what we've talked about is related with all aspects of biology, but before we get into some diabetes, let's start with a simple one. Respiratory ailments, asthma, you know, obviously it plays a role then, right?
Yeah. And that's actually, so the person I trained under, Patrick McCown, he was asthmatic. And so retraining his body to tolerate higher levels of carbon dioxide helped him essentially, replace his need of inhalers and things like that and the medications he was on. A lot of people have similar benefits, especially with asthma. That's one of the biggest ones with the Buteyko method. Retraining yourself to tolerate higher levels of carbon dioxide is going to help you with basically reducing that feeling of breathlessness that comes along with asthma. There's a lot of people that there's so much good information out there. I would just point people to the Buteyko clinic. That's a good starting point. And then, yeah, that's probably the best place. If you start with the Buteyko clinic, if you're interested in asthma, breathing for asthma, they have an unbelievable amount of resources. And that's one of the quickest way. That's one of the best conditions it helps with. Now, it might not completely fix it, but it might help reduce your need for a rescue inhaler or reduce your need for a little bit of medication and things like that. Just by, of course, it's related to breathing. Mm. Let's start with the breath and then add on all the other things that need to be done. But breathing is one of the most natural places to start.
Beautiful. And now diabetes.
Yeah. How long do you have?
Yeah. That's right. Summary.
Yeah, summary. Okay. Well, so with diabetes, there's so many different ways in which breathing helps. So I'll start with the autonomic nervous system. So by balancing the sympathetic and parasympathetic branches of the nervous system, that fight or flight sympathetic, the calming parasympathetic, that's one of the biggest problems with diabetes is autonomic dysfunction, where we're at a heightened level of sympathetic state. Our blood sugars are fluctuating. We're stressed out, all of these things. We're sleeping poorly. So by practicing slow breathing around 4 to 6 breaths per minute, 5 to 6 breaths per minute, you can kind of find what's right for you. That's going to balance your autonomic nervous system. And that can, within a couple minutes, can bring you to levels of non-diabetics with markers like heart rate variability and baroreflex sensitivity. So there's these kind of markers we can check. And for diabetes, that's one of the quickest ways. There's also blood pressure. So diabetics have a much higher rates of hypertension, which kind of just makes sense given all the other things that fluctuating blood sugars impact. And slow breathing is actually, it's acknowledged by the American Heart Association as a treatment for hypertension because countless studies and meta-analyses have shown that it consistently reduces your blood pressure. So by practicing slow breathing, reducing blood pressure, you're going to help with those cardiovascular risks, which is, I think, the number one killer of diabetics is cardiovascular complications. Stress and anxiety is another huge one. I've already kind of alluded to this. The stress of having diabetes is it's a full-time, 24/7, 365 job. We never get any breaks. And so by having a tool at your disposal, you can use anytime, anywhere to help just relax you, to give you a sense of control. That's one of the best benefits of breathing for diabetes because you're going to lower your levels of stress. You're going to lower your levels of anxiety, and that's going to help you, again, feel in control, give you that power to take control of your blood sugars. We know breathing is a huge part of it is improving blood flow, improving oxygenation. And these are all, I mean, that's what diabetes, our problems with our feet and things like that. It all comes down to reduced blood flow. And so if we can try to use, again, it's not going to fix everything, but if we had this tool that we can use anytime to help with our blood flow, and then it's going to help get the oxygen to the tissues and cells where it's needed, that's going to be super beneficial. So I think the last one I should mention is the tissue oxygenation, because tissue oxygenation is one of these catch-alls for diabetic complications. So the theory is that diabetics get less oxygen delivered to their cells. That causes things like insulin resistance. It causes this chronic sympathetic fight or flight activation because you're not getting enough oxygen. And by practicing these slow breathing techniques that optimize gas exchange, that optimize carbon dioxide, give you that nasal nitric oxide, do everything you can to get the oxygen in and delivered to the cells is going to have significant improvements for your diabetes. So I'll stop there. I could go on all day, but that's a good
one. Yeah, it's so important. And even for those diabetics who like, I'm not stressed, I meditate and do all these things you talked about, that just that blood flow and that enhanced blood circulation, everything about that will just enhance it much more. And this notion of utilizing the oxygen more efficiently and actually not only breathing, but moving it from the blood into the cells reminds me of hydration. I'm very big on proper hydration and on water because so many people are just, we are definitely having epidemics of dehydration and dryness, and you're not going to solve it by drinking water, because the problem is you're drinking the water, you're getting into the gut, and the next step is get from the gut into the bloodstream, which is a bit easier. But for them, what people are able to do is get it from the blood into the cells, intracellular hydration. And it just reminds me of so much of that. And it's such a simple foundational aspect and element in our life, you know, air and water. And it's this inability to pass it. It's in Ayurveda we call vata. It's that movement, that thing which moves it into the next phase or transferring.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's a perfect analogy. I don't know. I'll have to get some more information from you on that, because that sounds like an excellent analogy, metaphor of how this is happening. I use, for any diabetic listening, I use the analogy of insulin. So we can eat sugar, right? We can go eat an apple or a banana, and we get that sugar, it gets into our bloodstream. But what's the most important thing? It's we need to get it out of the bloodstream into the cells and tissues where it can be used. And that's actually what you know, diabetes causes is it becomes toxic because we don't have enough insulin and the sugar accumulates in our blood. And so that insulin is the trigger to get it out of our blood and into our cells and into our tissues. Same thing with carbon dioxide. We have this oxygen. We can take all the big breaths we want, but if we can't use it, what's the point, right? And so if you're a diabetic, you can think of carbon dioxide as kind of the insulin of oxygen. So that's another way to think about it. Yeah,
that's beautiful. I love that. Okay, before we wrap up, can we, of course, there's so many breathing exercises you can do, and you go to yoga class or even just someone who has good knowledge on pranayama, the science of breathing and science of administering prana into the cells. There's so many you can do. But we spoke about, in terms of practicalities, you spoke about just slow breathing. You said, you kept saying 5 to 6 breaths per minute of just in and out the nose. And that's what I'm big on. Just like I always say to people, one simple thing that you can do is breathe in and out your nose, but as long and as slow as you can. Like, see how long you can do it. Like, you know, I know someone who can breathe in for 1 minute and breathe out for 1 minute. Like, see how slow you can do it. So that's a simple one. And yeah, what would you advise that people can do?
Yeah,
as a beginning,
that's a great suggestion. Just slow breathing. So I'm a big fan of using like different phone apps just to guide you to these rates. I try to be a good balance of technology and no technology, but for this case, I like using an app of some sort to guide you to around 4 to 6 breaths, 5 to 6 breaths per minute. That's kind of the sweet spot for most people to optimize their heart rate variability, to get that calming response. And so, yeah, you could do, for example, a good starter breath is 4 seconds in, 6 seconds out, through the nose only, and see how you feel. Do it for like maybe 2 minutes just to get a feel for it. And you will notice improvements in your state and your relaxation and things like that. And that's one of the easiest places to start and move from there. There's, like you said, there's tons of different breath work practices. There's tons of different pranayama practices. There's box breathing. There's all of these things we could be trying, but just slow breathing is where I usually tell people to start. And the apps I use, yeah. I use one called iBreathe, and then I use one called Breathwork. And it's without the O, so it's breath, W-R-K. Those are the two I like to use. Simple, quick, you know, nothing. It's a nice clean apps that I really enjoy.
And Nick is kindly giving away 1 year subscription to the app Breathwork.
That's right, yeah.
And yes, that you can check out at the end of this podcast and also in the show notes how to enter it. And I think that's good. You can start with the apps, learn the things, and then you learn them, and then you won't need the technology.
And that's the best thing about breathing is it's there all the time. So you can train yourself to just tap into it whenever you need it, find a rate that's comfortable for you, and do the one that's right for whatever circumstance you find yourself in.
Beautiful. And the last thing I want to ask is, for me, like, I meditate, I do yoga, I do other things, but I don't do so much breath work as much as I perhaps would like to. And I was just talking to Dr. John Douliard, like learning how it's just so powerful. I mean, even Dr. John Douliard, who's been doing so much Ayurveda, so much meditation, he's just like breath. So what about I've been doing it the whole day since I've been like preparing for this episode. I've been doing it during this talking to you, is just breathing while I'm working.
There you go.
I'm breathing while I'm cooking. And obviously it's not the same, and it's hard to kind of multitask at times, but let's talk about that for people who maybe don't have the time or who don't prioritize the time to sit down for 5 to 10 minutes to do breath work. What about doing it while multitasking?
Yeah, definitely. So it's a good way to bring you into the moment. So for example, if you catch yourself distracted, you can bring it back to the breath and then get back to what you were doing. So I can't remember the book now. I want to say it was Neurodharma by Rick Hansen. Or no. I'm saying the wrong book. So let me stop. But in any case, there's a story, a little parable of basically, you know, someone, you and I are talking, and then you ask me, Nick, you're not paying attention. And I say, oh no, I'm focusing on my breath. Sorry. Like, we don't want to become, you know, too good for life because we're so into our breath. We want to use it to experience life better. And so it's a good gateway to bring you back to the present. So let's say you're washing dishes. You could be doing a little, you might find that you're just wandering. You might say, oh, I'm going to come back to my breath, take a few deep breaths, noticing it. And then you might be more present washing the dishes. But one of my favorite ways of actually incorporating, you know, a breathwork practice into the day is walking. So counting your steps with your breath, it's very meditative and time flies. It's a really interesting state. They call it breath walking. I'm a big fan of walking. That's like the only exercise. It's one of my only exercises I do is just walk a lot. And so,
especially for insulin and for blood sugar, right. It's so powerful.
Yeah. Post meal and things. There's a lot of research showing it can help with the blood sugar spikes, but I just really enjoy walking because I can listen to books and things like that. But if I turn all that off, and a lot of times in my backyard, I do this in between tasks, is you just focus on, say, like 4 steps during the inhale, 6 steps during the exhale, or whatever is comfortable for you. And that's a really nice way to bring in both. It's kind of meditative because you have to count the steps, but it's also really nice breath practice because you're syncing the steps with the breath. You know, all the nasal breathing, you're getting all these benefits without having to sit and, you know, take time out of your day. Just do it while you're walking between tasks, or if you're going down the hall to the office, you know, things like that. These are micro moments you can bring in some breath work.
Beautiful. Thanks so much, Nick. So you're listening, I'm sure you're already breathing consciously through the nose and continuing all your activities. And yeah, I think if you can take the time out, whether it's 5 minutes a day or once or twice or 3 times a day to do it, just closing your eyes or just that, it's so powerful and you'll reap big benefit. So if you want to learn more about Nick, his website's pretty awesome. It's takes scientific papers a lot on breath and transfers it to you in a digestible way, because scientific papers can be hard to read. And I love reading them, but I love even more when someone is there to guide you through it. So it's very helpful and very makes it much more interesting and easier. So what's your website again?
TheBreathingDiabetic.com. So find anything. I have a newsletter that goes out once a week. I've been doing for, two and a half years now, called The Breathing 411. Just a fun way to learn about breathing. So that's another easier, more digestible way if people are interested in learning more.
Beautiful. And Breathing Diabetic on Instagram. And anything else you want to mention before we leave?
No, I appreciate you having me on, and I hope that please, if you have any questions, I love emails, and I love getting emails and chatting and discussing. So nick@thebreathingdiabetic.com, send me any questions, and if it takes me a while, I'll research it and find the best answer or send you to someone that knows more than me. So
beautiful. Thanks, Nick.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Dylan.
Thank you for joining me, and I'm sure you're going to be more conscious of your breath now, right? I am, since I've started listening to Nick and learning from Nick and just from all the experts, John Dulliard, and honoring breath more in every moment. And hey, I bet you will be, next time you exercise, keeping your mouth shut. Really embody that mastery of your exercise. It's such an important thing, nasal breathing, especially exercise. Don't let the exercise take over you, and that causes stress response and other undesirable effects. So for the competition, Nick is giving away a 1-year subscription to Breathwork. So what y'all got to do is find the Instagram post associated with this podcast, share it on your story on Instagram, tag Vital Vader and The Breathing Diabetic when you share it, and add to your share, I want you to write one takeaway you got from this episode. And as well as that, comment on the post, one takeaway you got from this episode. And you can also, if you don't have Instagram or you want to enter for a second time, leave a review on the Vital Vader podcast and mention one takeaway you got from this episode. Both of those will be counted as an entry for you to win 1-year subscription to the app Breathwork, where, how awesome, you get an app to guide you through some breathwork and the multitude of different breathworks for accessing different states of consciousness, for accessing different interventions for health, for addressing certain health conditions. All those are on the Breathwork app, Breathwork without the O. And once you learn them, you got them. You know, do it for a year, you'll know, learn them off by heart, or even they'll take less than a year and boom, you got it. So that's how you all got to enter. And until next time, my friend, much, much love. Breathe easy.